Ron Carter, Diane Reeves, and more. Details at dcjazzfest.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
And welcome to WPFW Washington, WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We are a Pacifica station lasting for more than 47 years, and we have every intention to go strong further because you, the listener, support this Jazz and Justice radio station 50,000 watts strong, but more importantly, empowered by your social connectivity, and the financial wherewithal you provide. I'm David Whetstone. This is the hour of We the People, and I want to join my other programmers and staff in thanking listeners, new and renewing, for getting us through a successful summer pledge drive, even with a number of technical problems that we suspect are not of our doing. You have brought us through yet another quarter, another season, and hopefully another year. And for that, I thank you wholeheartedly. You can hear the happiness in my voice. Again, thank you. Our guest today will tell us about Anna May Wong. Anna May Wong is not your China doll. She is the international movie and cultural icon that had her launch in life work in the advent of Hollywood in the American film industry. You probably have seen images of her, at least in 2022. There was a commemorative quarter which honored her, but this woman was incredibly stunning in every sense with her life and work and what she means for us in our cultural landscape. To help us understand and appreciate all that, Katie G. Salisbury is the author of Not Your China Doll, a new biography of Anna May Wong, who is the first Asian-American, first Chinese-American movie star. Ms. Salisbury's work has appeared in the New York Times, Vanity Fair, The Believer, and the Asian-American Writers Workshop, and elsewhere. She's a finalist for the Jerome Hill Artist Fellowship in 2021, and she gave a TED Talk called American as Chop Suey. I recommend it heartily for our listeners. She also writes the newsletter on Subtract blogging called Half Caste Woman, and she's a fifth generation Chinese American who hails from Southern California. Well, thank you for being with us this morning. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, David. I'm excited to be here.
Larger than life. I hope people hear the result of the exposure and experience I've had of Anna May Wong, and I hope they make it theirs as well. Let's start out with you and your work and how Anna May Wong fits in to all of this.
Sure. Well, I identify as mixed, both as Asian American, but I'm part Chinese, part Irish and English. And I grew up in a suburb of Southern California that was, by the time I was in high school, majority Asian American. But yet, when I went to college and I started doing my first summer after freshman year, I did an internship at the Chinese American Museum in Los Angeles. I go to the museum on the first day I'm working there. The curator gives me a tour of photographs that are in one of the exhibition rooms. And there's a photograph of Anna May Wong, and I don't know who she is. I've never heard of her. No one's ever mentioned her to me. But I see this woman, and I know there's something special about her. So I ask, you know, who is she? And when I get the answer, you know, she was this internationally famous Chinese-American movie star from the 1920s and 30s. She grew up in Los Angeles, had this fabulous life. You know, my jaw dropped. I just couldn't believe that. I mean, it was hard enough in the 90s when I was growing up to find Asian American role models on television and in movies. So to think that there was someone like her in the 1920s doing that was like, you know, out of this world. And then to realize that no one remembered who she was like such a travesty. It was like, how could this be? And I went home and asked my mom. I asked a lot of friends. No one had really heard of her or knew what she was about. And so, I mean, that was 20 years ago, actually, exactly this summer. 20 years ago, that set me on this journey to really wanting to know who she was, but also share her story with others, because I felt it was a great injustice to let the legacy of such an important film pioneer just fall to the wayside.
And with that incredible story, it's really fueled your career of scholarship and writing. And thank you. Let's begin with some basics. Just tell us, Anna May Wong was born in 1905 in Los Angeles, I believe January 7th, or January 5th, if I got the date correct.
January 3rd.
Okay. Oh, my goodness.
The mountains, downtown city, which can be any city in America. They have Spanish missions. There's all these beautiful exotic locales. So they're setting up shop in the streets of Los Angeles, oftentimes in Chinatown, because Chinatown is free atmosphere. They don't have to build a set. All they have to do is show up. So Anna May Wong, this little girl with her older sister, Lulu, you know, as any good immigrant child knows whose family has a small business, you're also helping out at the small business when you're not at school. So they're delivering laundry to clients, you know, all sorts of things, working in the business. So while they're out and about, they see these studios set up on the streets. And that's Anna May Wong's first exposure to this thing called filmmaking. And pretty soon, you know, starts skipping school, saving the tip money she gets from her dad's customers to go to the Nickelodeons. And she goes there and watches the films reel to reel, and then quickly rushes home to reenact all of the scenes she's just witnessed in front of the mirror. So she very early on like found this thing she's incredibly drawn to, you know, she has a talent for. And so by age 11 or 12, she's already decided that she's going to be a movie star, which is pretty incredible, given that the films themselves had only really been around, you know, I mean, as an industry for less than a decade at that point.
And I just want to emphasize, she becomes the master of crying at age 12 by practicing, rehearsing in front of a mirror, no doubt. Maybe it's not so minor, but there's two important things about her school experience. She goes to two different schools, and in two different settings, she gets two different treatments. Can you just tell the audience what she underwent?
Absolutely. So the interesting thing, I mean, turn of the century, Los Angeles is not quite the metropolis we think of yet. And I do go into this a lot in the book too, about the context in which her parents, who are also American born, you know, there, it was her grandparents who came to America from China during the gold rush. So she's really a third generation Chinese American. But her father, you know, had come of age during the Wild West years, when there were a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment, right? You see the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882, which bars immigration from China. And there's a lot of violence towards Chinese. They want them out. So that's kind of been his experience. So by 1905, you know, we think, well, some of those things have settled down. I mean, part of it is that there aren't as many Chinese people anymore. They have left. They've been driven out. Few of them have been able to start families, but, you know, in Wong Samsing's case, he was able to marry a Chinese woman and start this family. So Anna Mae Wong and her sister Lulu, you know, they're going to a regular American school in Los Angeles with other American children. Anna Mae Wong actually writes about this in one of her early memoir pieces for a movie magazine, and talks about not understanding that she was different from the other children, right? She felt just as American as anyone. But it's an experience that she and her sister have walking home from school one day. Their, you know, white classmates essentially chase them down. They call them the C word, which I won't repeat, but I think everyone knows what I'm talking about. They pull their pigtails, they throw things at them, they're essentially chanting a racial slur at them all the way home. And the little girls, they don't, you know, they rush home to their father, upset, in tears. They don't know what to think of this, right? Anna Mae says, like, what did I do? You know, what did I do that was so wrong, that was so bad to deserve this treatment? Which is really heartbreaking to think about from her perspective, like feeling that she had done something wrong. And so her and her sister at this young, tender age have this heart to heart with her father. He puts them on both of her knees and says, you know, you're Chinese, you're Chinese American. And that means you're different from others. It doesn't mean, you know, you should always be proud of your Chinese heritage, but it means that sometimes your position in this country is going to be difficult. And so that, from that early age, Anna Mae Wong starts to have this understanding of race in America, that there's this kind of hierarchy, and that she is somehow different. And because of that, she'll be treated differently. And it, you know, so she has this very young awareness of that. And because of that whole experience, the parents pull them out of the California school, which was the American school, and put them into the Chinese mission school, which is run by American missionary women, but it's all Chinese students. So they're in good company. They're with people like themselves. And so the taunting and the bullying stops.
Okay. And then once again, we're situated in Los Angeles with Anna Mae Wong, particularly Southern California, a strange admixture of Midwesterners, temperance advocates, some out and out racists who are like colonizers, whether it's the gold rush or railroad, you know, all those things are coming together. And here comes the film industry in the late 19th century, going into the 20th, there's a whole representation and advent of change. As fascinating as this is, here's this young girl who makes her way in this setting. And you said it earlier, she winds up paying attention to movies, both the Nickelodeon and also the movie sets. And in the community, she becomes I forgot the appellation you gave her, but she becomes known for being present while movies are being made.
Yes, she's the curious Chinese child.
Okay. And so her youth is going to be something, but if we advance, oh, there's one thing I wanted to say. You mentioned how the community was under siege. At the height of the gold rush, there was at least 150,000 people of Chinese origin in the States, if I'm not mistaken. But by the 20s, the 1920s, that population gets reduced to about 61,000. And so that gives you an idea of what a little policy plus racial hostility can do, folks. Well, let's proceed further. Your book starts out with a fascinating and dramatic and very interesting story of Anna May Wong's appearance in The Thief of Baghdad. And for film aficionados, that's a hallmark film. That's a milepost in American filmmaking, done in part by Douglas Fairbanks. And so just share this experience. And why did you start out with the Thief of Baghdad?
Great question. When I started researching this book, I was reading a lot of biographies and memoirs about early Hollywood titans like Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, their friend Charlie Chaplin. And I kind of fell in love with them a little bit. And I thought this was such a fantastic opportunity to introduce the world of Hollywood and that Anna May Wong is stepping into, just as she's about to make a name for herself. And in a sense, kind of like fast forward to the most exciting part of her career. And then we can kind of go back and look a little bit more at her background and her family. But, you know, The Thief of Baghdad was, in its time, the biggest movie that had ever been made in Hollywood, which is kind of a recurring pattern throughout the book, as well as in Hollywood in general. Everyone wants to outdo each other. And so it's this kind of incredible opportunity for her at 18 to walk onto this, to be a part of this set and this film as a somewhat unknown actress. But it's also this really interesting, you know, fabulation of all these different things, right? In fantasy, an Arabian Nights tale, and Douglas Fairbanks, you know, what that means to him is something perhaps it doesn't mean to us today, right? It's kind of bringing in all the quote unquote exotic elements in the world, which means not only people from the Middle East, but, you know, we want Asians, we want Black actors, we want all sorts of people. And, you know, Douglas Fairbanks is also playing Thief of Baghdad in brown face as an Arab. And he's not Arab, he's white. And they cast, you know, Mexican Americans from Los Angeles to come play the Arabs, right? Like they're doing all of these things. And in a way, it becomes an opportunity for Anna May because he sees her in this previous film, The Toll of the Sea, sees that she has acting chops and thinks, well, I'm going to cast her. She's exotic. I can cast her along with a lot of these other Asian actors. And she's put in this role, the Mongol slave, which is probably the most unlikely breakout role for a young woman in Hollywood.
At 18, yeah.
At 18. And, you know, and she's also, she's young and beautiful. She's wearing the skimpiest outfit, aside from Douglas Fairbanks himself, who, you know, kind of wears some short shorts. So she gets the attention of all these different people in this film. And I think it's also just fun to see the behind the scenes of what's going on with that, like what kind of world Hollywood is, right? It's filled with all these really playful spirits like Douglas Fairbanks, who makes his entire studio into a kind of playground, right? You're with all of these fun, creative people. There's costumes, there's makeup, there are people building sets. There are famous people visiting, Babe Ruth and, famous ballerinas, and all of these things happen. And she's kind of just thrown into this environment and like, let's see how she does in it, right? And let's also see like the glamour and the glitz of the experience. Like, can you imagine like being this 18-year-old girl and inducted into Hollywood history in this type of way? And so that's why I wanted to start there, because I think it's just such a great window into the world that we're about to enter.
And you mentioned The Toll of the Sea. I want to say that it's very much a breakout because Anna May Wong appears in the earliest, one of the earliest presentations of Technicolor, two-color colorization of film. Yeah. And Thief of Baghdad represents, you know, big production, hundreds of thousands of dollars. If you extrapolate to
millions.
Millions, actually.
Yeah.
And big production, big box office. The early signal that that's the way Hollywood's going to work from then to almost, I would say forever, if not now. And but what goes along with that is something you make very clear in the narrative around her life. There's an importance of news and entertainment media. You rise and fall with your interaction with journalists and reporters. The questions they ask become frames. They frame things. They're meta frames. And Anna Mae Wong is going to run into that all throughout her life, We can go in so many directions, but I'm going to give listeners a clue that in just a few minutes, you're going to hear us start talking around the theme, what's in a name? And that's particularly important with Anna Mae Wong. But before I do this, allow me to reintroduce Katie G. Salisbury. She's the author of Not Your China Doll. It's a new biography about Anna Mae Wong, who's the first Chinese-American, first Asian-American movie star, but she's an icon. She's internationally renowned. Her, pardon the expression, her arena wasn't just film. It was fashion. It was theater. It was culture. And all those things, she made an outstanding mark on our culture and on our history. And it's that kind of appreciation we want to bring forth. Is it too early to talk about cultural appropriation? There's an elephant in the room of Yellowface that's going to come up really soon. You mentioned Douglas Fairbanks took upon brown skin, but he also was a charmer, and he was a charmer not only among his immediate peers, but when he crossed cultures, he engaged people. The early Black actor Sam Baker played the Sultan Guard, and he learned a lot of different things. He interacted with the Chinese-American community. And again, we haven't emphasized this strongly, but most of the people in that Los Angeles community, what about a third of them had some sort of contact with the movie industry, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, what are we to,
yes, that's correct.
What are we to make of things? One thing that stood out for me in this early chapter was, as much as he was charming and somewhat supportive of Anna Mae Wong, when his PR people made a mistake regarding her name, he just tried to smooth it over in a, I would guess, kind of a patronizing or patriarchal way.
Right, yes. So the thing is, we don't actually know what happens. We know a few little reference points. You know, Douglas Fairbanks tells the New York Times a story that he had these difficulties with his exotic cast, right? His Asian, the different Asian actors. And he mentioned Anna Mae Wong as one of them and how she gets upset because the PR man gets her Chinese name wrong. He says that instead of two yellow willows, it's two yellow widows, something like that. And she gets so angry that, you know, she won't go on to set. He has to apologize to her parents, something like that. That story to me personally doesn't quite add up. It sounds like there was something left out, like some critical piece of information, right? I mean, what I do know is that from Anna Mae Wong's perspective, she told a separate reporter that she had told people on set what her Chinese name was. It's actually, she kind of gets it wrong here too, because, well, as a Chinese American, you don't actually know what your Chinese name is. You have to have someone else translate it for you. So it's later she says it's Frothing Yellow Willows, which is the name that she goes by. But in this instance, she says two yellow willows. She hasn't gotten it right yet. But anyway, she's telling the people on set, okay, this is what my Chinese name is. And supposedly this became a joke. They started joking, oh, well, Julianne Johnston, who was playing the princess, maybe she's a couple of Peach Melbas. And, you know, the other guy, Edward Snitz, is, you know, a couple of Lots in Glendale or something. They're making all these jokes. They're making light of her name. And I don't know whether she appreciated that or not. Probably not. But you could see how that could have quickly devolved into something else, right? A racial epithet. Other unpleasantness. I mean, they were already referring to the Japanese actor Kamiyama Sojin as Slow Jin, because the director said it was easier for him to remember and say that way. So there's these little microaggressions, or maybe they're not so little. Like, we don't know exactly what happened, but I do think that this is an important moment in Anna May Wong's career, because if she's saying she's not going to go on set until she gets an apology, that means something serious happened, and it was likely had to do with her race. Because she also said about this time that she had kind of turned a corner in her thinking about these types of aggressions, right? She had one day walking down the street in Los Angeles, the truck driver yelled a racial slur at her, and she yelled back at him, and he was taken aback. And she's like, that was when I turned the corner, right? I'm never going to let someone talk to me like that again. So I think that, you know, we see also in this, you know, interesting, very diverse cast, there are still these tensions, right? Because Douglas Fairbanks, as progressive as he thinks he is for the time, like, he wants to be friends with everyone, right? He wants to be a man of the people, which means everyone. And in some sense, he is more open-minded than many others in Hollywood. He's actually casting, you know, Black, Asian, well, Latinos, I mean, as Arabs, I mean, but he's casting these people in his film, whereas other people wouldn't even go there, right? So it's a slight difference, but it just shows you what she's up against, right? Even the most progressive person is going to have issues and misunderstandings and diminish things that she's experienced.
It's the harbinger of things to come for Anna May Wong. It really is. And I think what can be received from your book is the overwhelming automatic sense, the racist hubris that these practices were put upon Anna May Wong. And it was just swimming in the atmosphere. It was constantly in the ether of wherever you went, particularly the film industry. I don't know, we're almost at the halfway point in our show, and you've done such a fine job. I want to make sure we're not understating her own power, the courage it took to make, you know, I'm not going on the set, but also in her craft, even at a young 18 going into her 20s, she's one of the few actors that really made a successful transition from silent films to talkies. And it's because she was the master of crying again, can cry on command. She was very sensitive to facial and motion expressions, not only regarding emotion, but really conveying story and persona. I think anyone can argue she was simply outstanding with that. Yet, and I talked about this earlier, people want to decide and control her. They want to really define her. And right away, there's this whole thing of, at an inconvenient time, she's too American or too Angelino. And other times, she's too Chinese. And it's like, which is it? And there's obviously, it would be much sadness to submit yourself to someone who moves the goalpost or the line of definition over and over again. Can you just talk about her early response to all this, particularly from journalists? Some of the questions they asked her were very telling.
So journalists are not sure what to expect when they're going to meet Anna May Wong, right? Like, she's been in silent films. People actually don't know what she sounds like. They don't know what her voice is. And they've made a lot of assumptions about who she is, right? It's in a time when people don't really understand what it means to be a hyphenated American, right? To be Chinese American there wasn't a consciousness of that. So they think, well, if you're Chinese, you must be from China, right? And not that at all. She's American. She speaks like any young American girl of her era. She's a flapper. So she's dressed very fashionably. She's using all the slang and lingo, which really takes people by surprise. I mean, there's countless articles that begin by describing her as this mythical Chinese maiden out of a book of Chinese poems. And then, you know, she opens her mouth and ruins the entire illusion because she doesn't sound like what she looks like to them. So there's that interesting experience that is chronicled again and again in the interviews she does. And of course, they're also alluding to the, oh, East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. I mean, there's all these really, these preconceived notions of like, you know, East and West will never understand each other. They'll never truly mix, et cetera. When here you have this woman who is both, she's both. And so along with it, of course, as most young actresses experience, the media wants to know, who are you dating? Are you going to get married? I mean, in this era, you don't really date so much as you get married. And it's like, well, who will you marry, Anna May Wong? Will you marry a Chinese man or will you marry a white man? And I mean, it's kind of a trick question because in that era, it's illegal to marry a person of another race. So she can't marry a white man. Everyone knows that, unless she like flees to Mexico.
Everyone knows that, including the questioners. Yeah.
Right, right. And then she goes into the fact that, like, well, if I were to marry a Chinese man, he would have all these expectations of me, right? He doesn't want me to have a career. He would want me to be a wife, to make a home for him, to have children. And that's not what I want for myself. I'm an independent woman. I'm modern. And so she's kind of caught in this, you know, wrong between a hard place. Like you said, never enough of either thing. And she has to carve out her own path for herself in terms of what she wants, like how she sees her own life. And I think that's one of the things that makes her so relatable today, is that she was incredibly modern for a woman in the 1920s. This wasn't a normal thing for a woman to go around saying, I'm going to have a career and I'm not going to get married. So even today, I think she's really inspiring in that way.
And we're talking about Anna May Wong, a cultural icon, the first Chinese American, first Asian American movie star. And we're talking with Katie G. Salisbury. Ms. Salisbury has studied this incredible person's life, and we're exploring the meaning and significance, not only it resting in the person of Anna May Wong, but what she did to and with the world. You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. I'm David Whetstone, your host. But more importantly, let's continue focusing on our subject after we serve you with these public service announcements. Won't you stick with us? We'll be right back.
Beloved listening audience, thank you so much for your tremendous support. Your unwavering dedication has taken WPFW over our goal despite a cyber attack. We are grateful for your generosity. It ensures that WPFW can continue to serve the people through our mission. If you missed the opportunity to pledge, you can visit WPFWFM.org to make a donation at any time. Together, we can build a better world, one broadcast at a time. I won't thank you.
The 20th anniversary of DC Jazz Fest happens August 28th through September 1st, featuring performances by Samara Joy, Jacob Collier, Stanley Clark, Emmett Cohen, Ron Carter, Diane Reeves, and more. Details at dcjazzfest.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
And we're back. Welcome to Week the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, our guest, Katie G. Salisbury. We're talking about Anna May Wong, who was the first Chinese American, Asian American female movie star. Who made a tremendous impact on American culture, and I would say international culture as well. Before we went to the break, we were talking about kind of the rip-roaring 20s, both of Anna May Wong, but of what's going on around her. She is a woman of fashion. She was a trendsetter in fashion. She just set the standard. You know, we're talking about her, and I know you practice photography and have really assembled some incredible pictures. I would urge people to dig a little further and even go to your website, and we'll repeat it several times before we leave Ms. Salisbury today, as well as your Subtract blog, half caste woman. It's very important, not only about Anna Wong, but about film history, about Asian American presence in film, past, present, and I think you're going to influence the future as well. So thank you. So she takes the flapper persona. Just give us an appreciation of that, if you will. Fast cars, incredible clothes, and some drinking and drinking and more drinking.
That's right. Fast cars. I mean, she buys a car before she even knows how to drive it. And her friend, Korean American Philip Ahn, actually has to drive her to set for The Thief of Baghdad. And when she does drive, she is in a number of either gets tickets or is in accidents that are publicized in the news. So she was certainly driving fast cars. Her fashion was on point. I mean, if you see any images of her from the 1920s, she is the image, spitting image of a flapper. And of course, you know, fraternizing with men, she's having lovers. And they are another race, a lot of older men who are artists and creators in their own right. And
quite a few directors. A few Britons from are in Hollywood, and they find her utterly fascinating.
She definitely has a type. British, Irish, you know, Charles Rocher actually ends up, he's a cinematographer, one of the early pioneers in Hollywood. He wins one of the first Oscars actually for cinematography. And he is one of her lovers. He dedicates a room in his home to her called the Anna Mae Wong Room. But he's actually kind of influential in her life too, because he has just returned from Germany and learning the techniques that they're using there, which introduces her to this circle of Germans and British expats who are all working and living in Hollywood. You know, they're thinkers, and but also movers and shakers. So this leads to an opportunity for her in Germany with UFA, which is the premier film studio there. They offer her a starring role in a film that's basically been written for her. And this is 1928. And so by this time, you know, Anna Mae Wong is a name, and Hollywood studios know this because they're using her to sell their films, putting her in publicity materials, billing her name with the principal actors, but they're not giving her the screen time to match. And often they're killing her off because they say, well, Anna Mae Wong, you can't be the lead in any of these films because you're Chinese. And if we put you opposite a white man, that's interracial mixing, and we can't have that. And therefore, you also can't have a happy ending. We have to show people morally, you know, like if you do cross these lines, you know, you get punished. So you will die, right? If you
suicide, self-poisoning.
I think there's sacrifice. One where she's buried. Buried alive. All sorts of things, ridiculous, absurd ways that she has to die. And so she's really fed up with this. Gets this offer from UFA. She's 23. It's a huge risk, right? If she leaves Hollywood and goes to Germany, who knows, like, what's going to happen? Will she ever come back? Will she still have a career? She's also, the farthest away she's from home she's ever been is Canada. She doesn't speak German. Like, how is any of this going to work, right?
I mean, also, if you go out of the country as an Asian American, particularly a Chinese American, it's hard to get back in.
Exactly, right. She's also had that learning experience on another production where they went to Canada, and she realizes, well, under the Exclusion Act as a Chinese American, she needs identity papers, and she also has to apply for permission to leave the country. And when she returns with the appropriate paper, she will then be interrogated to ensure that she is who she says she is.
And interrogation is the word. You give a sample of the questions she faced in your book. Thank you.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things riding on this, and it will take her extremely far away from home. I mean, it's not easy to just call someone on a telephone from Germany. I mean, you have to send telegrams, all sorts of things. So, you know, she takes all this into consideration. And being the kind of woman she is always a risk taker and believes in herself, right? She knows she's talented. She needs an opportunity to show what she can do. And this is it. So she decides to go. And so her and her older sister, Lulu, who becomes her, you know, kind of a companion on this trip, they sail across the Atlantic to Germany. And so begins her European sojourn, which she ends up staying for almost 3 years, and becomes this huge triumph for her. She becomes a sensation in Germany and moves on to France and England and does the same thing, and creates what I would argue are some of her best films during this period.
If mesmerizing was the word to be used, it's certainly the case with Anna May Wong. You mentioned Piccadilly, I think, earlier, which really, it was almost like a nova, a starburst, so to speak. So I am catching myself because I know we're running out of time and there's so much richness to her life. She goes to, I believe, Berlin first, learns German, and is conversant in German and eventually French as well. It might be a good time to stop and say, in all these sojourns, she is encountering all sorts of people, not in any particular order, but I'll just name people. Charlie Chaplin and Sid Grumman of Grumman Chinese Theater, by the way. If people ever wonder why that theater is where it's at in Los Angeles and Chinatown and Asians are where they're at, just know that that's a historical marker to pay attention to. Paul Robeson, Vincent Price, Anthony Quinn, Edith Head, the costume designer. Importantly, are her Asian compatriots too. You mentioned Philip Ong earlier. You know, his career went well into television, and I don't want to date myself. The only unfortunate reference I can make is he was one of the priests or monks in Kung Fu, along with Ki Luk as well. James Wong Howe, who we could spend a program on alone, the cinematographer who, like Anna May Wong, had acted on courage and their own sense of personal integrity and creativeness, outstanding for film techniques that even help, pardon the expression, folks, even white actors to be more palatable, given the physicalities and demands of the actual filmmaking. James Wong Howe. All these people are important, and Anna May Wong is not to be neglected for her influence on them. She's a good cultural respecter and cultural observer. I'm mentioning Paul Robeson, and I'm talking a little bit too long here, but I will help you with this bridge. New York, London, Paris, Berlin, Shanghai, Hong Kong, even Australia, they're all important cultural stops for Anna May Wong. So where do we go from here? We honored her leap of courage to go to Germany, and somehow she gets it in her head to try theater. And that's not far afield from how she's approaching her acting overall. And I got the impression that there, again, media nitpicking, she wasn't, there was pettiness and she wasn't Asianish. There was a rite of passage for her. Tell us more about that.
Yes, so she lands in England. Piccadilly, as you'd mentioned, is one of the best silent British films of the era. Is a huge sensation for her work there. And then she's going to make her debut on the stage, on the West End, no less, in London. And she's offered a part in a play that essentially, it's a Chinese play. It's been translated and adapted, so it's been changed somewhat from the original Chinese. Aside from her and one other Chinese Australian actress, the entire cast is in yellowface, including a young Laurence Olivier. she's in this cast, and mind you, like no one has heard her voice. This is before talking. So what they're expecting, I don't know what it is, but it's not who she is or not how she appears on stage. And so there's all of these British reviews who say, oh, she's so beautiful, her skin's like porcelain, but her voice, it's terrible. It's, you know, like this terrible American twang. And so they can't stand it. And that's all they end up talking about is just the way her accent sounds, because it's jarring. It's not what they expected. And somehow it's less Chinese They think that, oh, well, this other British actress could have done a better job in it. And so it's, you know, incredibly offensive and tone deaf. And I think the only people who really seem to pick up on this, you know, month later are the Los Angeles Times and say, well, that's so funny that the British like everything about this Chinese play for its Chinese actress. But, you know, deals with it very deftly. I mean, she is a very diplomatic woman. I'm sure she understood it was completely unfair criticism. But at a press conference with all these critics who are asking about this and that, she said, you know what, well, I'm going to pay for elocution lessons. And she does. She learns to speak with a British tinged accent. And then at the end of the press conference, she says, and now I will say something in a language none of you can understand. And she rattles off something in Cantonese. She did this with humor and with grace. And she, you know, did her best to improve herself, even though, you know, this is not, I mean, what did they expect a Chinese actress from America to sound like? She, I mean, in my mind, she should sound American, and that's not what they want.
You know, and you're describing her voice. I really don't feel this is subjective, but if you hear her throughout her career, even at different points, there's an elegance and a regalness to it. At least that's how I would describe it. It's not just a mere affectation of doing the British study, as you said. Again, allow me to do some housework here, Ms. Salisbury. We're talking to Katie G. Salisbury, the biographer of Anna Mae Wong, who's the subject of today's show. She's truly one of the earliest international movie stars and cultural icons, and she brings a great significance and cultural impact in our history. We're fortunate that she passed our way and did the work that she did with us in the history of film. So many things to cover. We're still coming up on this cultural dissatisfaction by the powers that be, the persistence of yellow face throughout film and through theater and through the arts. She makes her mark. She proves herself, not that she has to prove herself to anyone, by making the biggest splash in Europe. And I think it's fair to say, Ms. Salisbury, she gains a lot of acceptance, at least on the surface, in England. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, I definitely think that she was taking a page out of, you know, Paul Robeson and Josephine Baker's books. I mean, she saw what they did. They had to leave America to be acknowledged and given the opportunities that they were worthy of. And so I think that she was really looking to them for inspiration and was able in many ways to do the same thing, right? I mean, of course, and I get into this in the book, I mean, it's not that Europe and Europeans weren't racist. I mean, but it's a different relationship to race, right? It's not as antagonistic. It's more of a fascination with these so-called exotic types, right? They haven't been exposed to people from other places, or people who are, you know, hyphenated Americans. I mean, who have a more mixed background than what they would have typically thought of as American. So they're really fascinated and interested. And so in a sense, it's a positive type of attention. I mean, but it comes with its own setbacks and consequences, right? I mean, there are still certain stereotypes that persist or roles that are more appropriate for you to play versus treating you as a full human being like any other person. So, I mean, Anna Mae and Paul Robeson, Josephine Baker, I think all experienced those things. But because of her sojourn in Europe, she has this triumphant moment. You know, people in Hollywood start to pay attention and realize, well, maybe we messed up. Maybe we missed something and we should give her another opportunity. So by the time she returns to the U.S., she lands... I mean, she lands in New York and is signed immediately to open a play on Broadway in 2 weeks. So she has 2 weeks to learn all her lines. It becomes a hit play. It's called On the Spot. She ends up performing in it for 5 months and then traveling around the country. By the time she makes it to Hollywood, Paramount is ready to give her a two-picture deal, the first of which is The Daughter of the Dragon, which is a starring vehicle for her. And they're pulling out all the stops for her. I mean, there are issues around that film that I won't get into, but the important thing is that she's kind of made her own opportunities here, right? She's gone off to Europe, proved herself. I mean, like you said, she didn't have to do that. Didn't need to prove herself, but she has, and Hollywood has taken notice, and so she's come back in this very triumphant way.
Well, we're gonna have to triumph with about 3 minutes to go here, and this is a shame, but it's an embarrassment of riches is what Anna May Wong offers us. The film that she was not in is so telling. Irving Thalberg did not keep his promise. And of course, you know that I'm referring to The Good Earth. Can you tell us what's important about this epic film, yet another blockbuster, but a blockbuster that wrongs Anna May Wong?
Yes. So The Good Earth, based on Pearl Buck's Pulitzer Prize winning book of the same name, is this sympathetic tale of two Chinese peasant farmers. That really humanizes the Chinese, which is why it was a best-selling novel and then became the film that Irving Thalberg had to make into this epic. And despite all these efforts to really showcase a sympathetic portrait of the Chinese, to make it authentic, I mean, they did all this work in China, buying up farms and shipping them back to Los Angeles so they could recreate the Chinese countryside. They hired all these Chinatown extras. I mean, they went to great lengths to try and make it authentic, right? But they couldn't bring themselves to cast Asian actors or Chinese actors, Chinese American actors in the principal roles. So you end up with a film where all the principal roles are played by white actors in yellowface. I mean, they boasted it was realistic yellowface, but it was still yellowface. And this is a huge disappointment and travesty for Anna May Wong, who, as soon as the film was announced, everyone thought, well, who could play the lead female role? It should be Anna May Wong. She's the only Chinese American actress of note. But of course, that's not what happens. And it goes to Louise Reiner, who is a German actress. She's actually only been in the US for a year. She's still working on her English. And yet that's somehow okay for a German actress when she's playing a Chinese character, whereas all the Chinese American actors who had been auditioned were either too, didn't speak enough English or were too Americanized. So again, you have that same, like, never enough problem. And, Anna May Wong, again, surprises us. She rejects a secondary role in the film. Basically says, I'm not going to play unsympathetic roles in The Good Earth, and goes on to do her own traveling to China.
Yes. And in that, she makes a documentary about China. She expresses and shares what returning to her homeland means. And we can't do it enough justice with under a minute to go. But what I've neglected, I'm sorry, Katie, is that how she was received among her own peers, how she was received in China. She understands her life evolves into proving within her community that the representation of the humanity of Chinese people is important and must be known. What would you say she leaves us today in less than a minute? It's unfair to you. Especially with the concerns of stopping Asian hate, of casting in Hollywood.
I think the lesson from her career is that change doesn't happen on its own. I mean, Anna May Wong was there at the beginning of Hollywood filmmaking, and yet it's taken us this long to see someone like Michelle Yeoh win an Oscar for Best Actress, right? That shouldn't be the case. I mean, granted, there has been a lot of progress in the last couple of years, but we can't stop. And it means you have to keep pushing like she did throughout her entire career.
It shouldn't take 80 or 95 years to achieve that sense of fairness and equity. Thank you, Katie G. Salisbury. This should have been a two-parter. My fault, we left out so much of how Anna Mae Wong speaks to us and can inspire us. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That will do it. I again want to thank listeners for their recent and continuous support. I appreciate you being with us this hour here at WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station. Coming up next, don't forget the blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner. And the news 5 minutes before each hour. I believe that Sue Goodwin or Chris Bangett Rounds will bring it to you from our News and Public Affairs Department. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer. And coming up at 1, Africa Now with host Moisa Mutale. Thank you, and perhaps we'll meet again next week.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Israel's launched a major military operation in the occupied West Bank, killing 10 Palestinians in Jenin and Tulkarem, and sparking fears it will broaden its war to the West Bank and forcibly displace Palestinians. The UK's Guardian is reporting Israeli forces have sealed off the city of Jenin. The Wafa News Agency is reporting bulldozers were also deployed, which have been used to destroy Palestinian homes. The AP's Charles de la Desma reports.
The governor of Jenin, Kamal Abu El Rub, said on Palestinian radio that Israeli forces had surrounded the city, blocking exits and entry points and access to hospitals and ripping up infrastructure in the camp. The Israeli military has confirmed it's operating in the city of Jenin and Tulkarem, but did not provide further details. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Haaretz is quoting military sources as saying one focus of the raid is a network suspected of a suicide bombing last week in Tel Aviv. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says one youth was injured by live bullets. Palestine's health ministry is reporting Israeli forces have killed at least 652 Palestinians in the West Bank since Hamas's October 7th attack in southern Israel. Hamas has no control in the West Bank. The Bedouin hostage Israeli forces say they rescued from Gaza after finding him alone in an underground tunnel is calling for an end to the war. 52-year-old Kaid Farhan Al-Qadi was captured during Hamas's October 7th attack in southern Israel. He told media it does not matter Arab or Jewish, all have a family waiting for them. They also want to feel the joy. I hope, I pray for an end to this. I told Bibi Netanyahu yesterday to work to bring an end to this. Israel says there are still 108 hostages in Gaza. About a third of them are dead. The Justice Department's special counsel Jack Smith has filed a new indictment against Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump over his efforts to undo the 2020 presidential election. The indictment narrows the original one in response to the Supreme Court's ruling that grants presidents broad immunity from prosecution and their officials. It keeps the same criminal charges, but narrows the allegations against Trump, removing accusations he tried to use law enforcement powers of the Justice Department to overturn his election loss. The new case no longer references Jeffrey Clark as a co-conspirator who was appointed by Trump as acting attorney general. The new indictment also stresses none of the other co-conspirators listed were government officials or were acting in a private capacity. The indictment still includes allegations Trump participated in a scheme orchestrated by his allies to enlist slates of fraudulent electors in battleground states won by Democrat Joe Biden, who agreed to falsely attest Trump had won those states. In a statement on his Truth Social platform, Trump called the new indictment an act of desperation and an effort to resurrect a dead witch hunt. He said the new case should be dismissed immediately. The Biden administration is offering federal resources to presidential candidates Republican Trump and Democrat Vice President Kamala Harris for presidential transition planning for the first time. Experts suggest both teams are already behind in preparing for their potential administrations. Trump has added two former Democrats who just endorsed him to his presidential transition team, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who suspended his presidential campaign Friday, and former Hawaii Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, who endorsed Trump Monday. Pacifica's Farah Siddiqui has more.
Anti-vaccine activist Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told right-wing commentator Tucker Carlson that he's been asked to work with Trump's sons. Should he win?
I've been asked to go onto the transition team and, you know, to help pick the people.